Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com.
From the Baltimore Sun, I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 330, for Friday, December 1st, 2017. We have two doctors in the house today. Dr. John Smarr is back with us from Sinai Hospital. Today he's going to help decode a certain podcast host's recent lab results. And Dr. Lydia Chang is joining us. She offers a history of quackery through the ages. So stay tuned for that. Plus, I have a few words of remembrance and appreciation for Richard Cross III, the mild-mannered, moderate Maryland Republican who was a frequent guest on this podcast, but who died unexpectedly in November. First, let's get the weekly book recommendation from Paula Gallagher. This week, Paula is crowing about a new book by an intrepid bird nerd, Noah Stricker, a young man who set out to see half the world's birds, about 5,000 species, in 1 year. Noah Stricker tells the story in Birding Without Borders, an obsession, a quest, and the biggest year in the world. Paula says it's a fun and fascinating read.
This book is a really nice book to read along with your smartphone or your tablet or your computer, because he's going to describe these birds and talk about birds he's seeing, and you're going to want to take a look at them. This is really a birding book and a little bit of a travelogue. He's seeing the world one bird at a time. And in the course of his adventure, he goes to 41 countries on 7 continents. And, you know, the whole world of birding, it's interesting. First of all, he's a millennial doing this. I always tend to think of older folks who are the birders. But technology and the internet, he talks about how they have really changed the world of birding. There are apps that help you to identify visually a bird, that help you listen to the call of a bird. And so there are fewer mysteries out there surrounding birding. One of the other things the internet has done is it's brought a worldwide community together. And so he's able to contact guides in various countries that he hears about, and he can put things out in group chats and things like that. He can go on social media and say, I'm going to be in this country, and find out who is available and who he can talk to and who is the legend and who will take him places. So he can be very focused in what he's doing. And so it's fun. It's an interesting journey. It's not a super long book. And I like one of the things that he says is that birding is hunting, collecting, and gambling rolled into one. And that's what makes it exciting for him. He's very passionate about his journey, about the birds, about ecology. So that comes in. So this is a book that's a lot of fun. The writing is very accessible. He's a likable person that you enjoy spending time with. And you find out some things that you may not have known about birding and what the rules are. For instance, the American Birding Association says any bird, in order for it to count, must be alive, wild, and unrestrained. So you can't go to the zoo and say, I'm checking off this box. And it's okay if you only heard the bird and didn't see it, as long as you make sure you're not hearing a recording that someone's playing something on their phone, maybe. So the book comes with some color photos in the middle. Again, you're going to want more than that. And you can, I always find myself watching videos of rare hummingbirds as I was reading this book. And then in the end, there's a 52-page appendix of all of the birds that he saw, where he saw them. So again, this is Birding Without Borders, An Obsession, A Quest, and the Biggest Year in the World by Noah Stricker.
Paula Gallagher is a librarian in the Baltimore County Public Library System. She'll be back in a week or so with a list of 2017 books that she thinks will make good gifts for the holidays. Next up, our first doctor in the house, Lydia Kang. Dr. Kang set out to study a subject that had not been offered back in medical school at NYU, remedies and treatments used through the ages, a history of medicine, basically. She and journalist Nate Peterson discovered some pretty weird and decidedly unhealthy practices, from ingesting all kinds of bad stuff, to bloodletting, to using the body parts of young, healthy, but dead criminals as cures for various ailments. Lydia Kang, a native of Baltimore, lives in Nebraska with her family. She practices medicine and writes books and poetry. Her collaboration with Peterson is Quackery, a brief history of the worst ways to cure everything. So, Dr. Kang, recently I had to have a procedure that required anesthesia. And I was talking to the anesthesiologist, a delightful doctor, and the attending nurse one moment, and the next moment I woke up. And the whole thing, I have no memory of it, and I had no pain from it, no feeling of it. And this is the world we live in.
I know.
It's great.
It's magical, isn't it? That's exactly what your hope is going to be, that when you're going to do something that you really don't want to be awake for, it's going to be just happening while you're asleep. And that is not the way it used to be.
I know. That's what we're here to talk about. That's why I brought that up. Might as well talk about anesthesia for a moment. I mean, goodness gracious, what was life like for people? What was surgery like? It must have been awful. All I can think of is whiskey and here, bite on this stick while I cut into your leg or something.
Oh, I know. Or maybe let's just like hit you with a hammer on the head so you're unconscious while we do it.
Did they do that?
You know, like there's stories of it. It's kind of hard to find actual records of it. But, you know, there wasn't good anesthesia. I mean, they tried to make up things, used alcohol. They would maybe soak some sponges in opium and hold them over people's, you know, nose and mouth. It really didn't work because, as anybody who knows, if you're just a little bit drunk and someone smacks you across the face, you'll still wake up. And if someone's sticking a scalpel in your belly, you'll feel it. So
yeah.
So what they had back then was surgeons who did things as fast as possible. So a really common surgery was, you know, having an amputation. During the Civil War, before that, you know, they didn't have a way to fix and heal legs. They just cut them off if they knew it was going to be a bad case. And without anesthesia, they had to do it fast because the patient would be screaming and writhing
right.
and
yeah.
yelling. And so they had people holding them down. They would sometimes tie them down. And it was in the surgeon's best interest and honestly to be as humane as possible, to do this as quickly as possible. But it was just as terrible. I mean, they would try to saw off a leg in 3 minutes.
So modern anesthesia or anesthesia at all is something post-Civil War, what, early 20th century, late 19th century?
Yeah, they had been experimenting with things like carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, basically things that if you inhale too much of them, you will definitely die. But they didn't know what to use, so they were experimenting with them. And once they did discover things like ether and chloroform, they had fun with it. Like, they were ether parties and chloroform parties where people would inhale them and get all giggly and weird and pass out.
Sounds like fun. I actually had, is it nitrous oxide that dentists will use?
Yes, nitrous oxide.
Do they still use
laughing
it?
Gas. They do.
Well, I haven't had it for a long time, but I do remember the one experience I had it. It was joyous. It was wonderful.
Yes, and there's a reason why they still use it. It does work. And when they first found it, they thought, God, the idea of being able to pull a tooth and not have somebody screaming in agony,
yeah.
that would be a good thing. And so it was a really fantastic, one of the first medicines that they used for anesthesia.
In Baltimore, once on Charles Street, and now at a different location, we had a museum of urology.
And really?
Yes. It still exists. It's just not on Charles Street where it used to be. I would sit in traffic in my car sometimes or in the bus and look out because they had a display that you could see from the street through the windows of those old tools, surgical tools.
Oh, they're terrible looking.
Oh my God, they look like tools of torture.
I know. I'd like, for some reason, you know, I read a lot about this procedure called the lithotomy, which is removing a stone from someone's bladder. And the position that they had to put you in to get it out, it looks pretty barbaric.
And the tool that was used?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes it was a finger. Sometimes it was like a stone grabbing tool kind of thing. They had lithotomy tools and they look like they were made by the devil.
Well, I guess we should be glad we live in the 21st century. I mean, there's a lot of things about the 21st century that aren't so hot. But based on the procedure I had recently and what we know generally about the progress that's been made, you know, things are pretty good compared to the way they used to be.
Oh, absolutely.
I have a number of things I wanted to ask you about from Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything. First, your interest in this. I'm curious about that.
Well, you know, it's funny because when you're in medical school, you got 4 years of learning everything you can possibly learn crammed into these 4 years. It's like really intense.
we don't actually have any classes on the history of medicine. So we hear about these famous names, you know, when we learn about these diseases and disease processes, but then we don't learn about how they were found or who they were, where, you know, what country they were even from. So when my co-author, Nate Peterson, said to me, hey, like, I think we should write a book on quacks. Now, he's a librarian and a journalist, and I'm a physician who writes fiction. So when he brought up the idea, I was like, I got to do this because I have so many things that I want to look up and I want to learn about. And I never got the education, so it was an opportunity for me to learn everything that I could about all these really strange ways we used to take care of ourselves and sort of fix this part of my own medical sort of, you know, history education that I was missing, to be honest.
And this is a deep dive. You guys go back centuries.
We do. We do. We go back to like Neolithic times. So
I'm curious about the things people ingested for various reasons. So I'm going to start with things that people ingested for various reasons. minerals, gold, clay comes up in this. Mm-hmm. People would ingest things thinking they were going to make them feel better.
Yeah, you know, they ate a lot of things that were really pretty awful. I mean, like in the beginning of the book, we've got listed like mercury, arsenic, strychnine. And, you know, you just start flipping through this going like, what were they thinking? And the story behind a lot of these is very varying. Like a lot of people thought that different medicines worked for very different reasons and for different diseases. So it kind of depends. Like each one has a very peculiar story. So like take mercury, for instance. We run screaming away from mercury now. Like, oh, my God, there's too much mercury in your fish. And, you know, we don't like to use mercury thermometers. We don't want it in our vaccines, all that kind
it'll
of stuff.
It'll cause brain damage.
It'll do all these terrible things, you know. So it's very seldom used in current medical care because it can be poisonous. So way back when, which is actually not that long ago, really was just 100 years ago and then well before that, people ate mercury all the time. It was in the form of a mercury salt, and oftentimes it was called calomel. And people would take it, and it would give you this horrendous diarrhea. I mean, that's how it worked.
So you could clear out.
You'd clear out. You were purging. And they wanted you to purge your body because they said if you can just get rid of the inside contents of your guts, you will make everything balanced and right. And so they used it to treat, my gosh, like everything. Teething, fevers, syphilis was a big one. It was really considered one of the best treatments for syphilis out there.
Okay. But the evidence that this was good for people was only that it would allow you to evacuate faster?
Yeah,
have diarrhea? Is that it?
There's a lot of reasons why people thought these things worked. I mean, one was that, let's say you're treating the common cold. Well, guess what? The cold gets better on its own anyway. And so people would say, hey, the mercury worked. Or they would use it for syphilis. And they would say, hey, I've got this really bad rash, and it's from syphilis. They take the medicine, and the rash would go away. Well, guess what? You know, the rash for syphilis will go away on its own anyway. So there was a lot of these, you know, conflicting reasons why people thought they worked. And I think one of the big ones was it did something to your body. Like, you took it.
And something happened. There was some reaction.
Exactly. You literally ran to the privy.
Right.
You emptied your guts out. Yeah. And afterwards, you're like, okay, it did something. I'm going to feel better. And maybe it was a
And that might have been enough for people.
Yes. Exactly.
Something happened. Because this is all guesswork. There's no evidence-based experimentation. There's no uniform testing of any of this, right?
Not back then.
Mm-mm. It's guesswork primarily,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. Another story I wanted to tell you. From 20 years ago, 25 years ago, an elderly gentleman in Baltimore that I knew very well would periodically lose a lot of weight. I'd see him and his clothes were hanging on him, and his name was Phil Dipsky. He owned had a bar in Canton. And I said, Phil, what's going on? And I learned that every time he was like this, he was doing his water diet.
Oh.
He would spend, I don't know, a month, 6 weeks, he claimed sometimes, doing nothing, ingesting nothing but water.
Oh, my gosh.
I don't know how he did it. I mean, I don't know how he didn't. He's passed away since then, but he would periodically, he felt this was a good way to purge, to clean out your insides. Mm-hmm. And I'm not exaggerating, at 4 weeks, sometimes 6 weeks of this, Maybe he supplemented his diet with some other things, but it was primarily a water diet. And water comes up a lot in your book.
Yeah. We have a whole chapter on water and water treatments. And, you know, the whole concept of drink your 8 glasses of water a day come from, you know, these ideas from the last century where water became this really, really trendy thing to do. So there were water spas where you could get hot water soaks and cold water soaks, get wrapped up in wet sheets and things like that. And people, it was actually a really good thing when you think about it. Way back when, like the idea of cleaning out a wound with water repeatedly was a novel idea. And it did do a lot of things for cleanliness and hygiene, but people sort of take it a little bit too extreme. And, you know, a water diet, not such a great thing as far as, you know.
And water wasn't necessarily clean back then, right? It could have had pathogens in it.
Yeah, right? It could have had cholera in it. It could have had dysentery. I mean, all sorts of bad things. So, but people... In some ways, it was good, and in other ways, probably not so good.
In Phil's case, he wanted the water to cleanse out his insides. You know, I wanted to use that word, evacuate again.
Mm-hmm.
He had an obsession with that.
Yes.
And this idea of clearing out the insides, enemas, this comes up in your book a lot, too. This is like an obsession with people, right?
Yeah. You know, people have been obsessed with their bowel movements since the dawn of time. They really are, because when it's not right, you feel not right. You feel like something's not, you just got to fix it as quickly as possible. The ancient Egyptians actually had, the guardian of the anus, which is like, you know, this person who was helping them make sure that their bowel movements were nice and steady and regular. Cleaning them out with purges and enemas was considered normal healthiness. So for the longest time, people thought that the inside of your your colon or your intestines might have this really dangerous toxin, and you had to get rid of it or else it would seep into your body and cause all sorts of mischief. And the truth is that the lining of your intestines are very good at keeping things where they're supposed to be. And obviously, you can understand why people thought it. I mean, if you look at a stinking pile of feces, it is dangerous. If you injected that into your arm, yes, you would get really deathly ill.
Right.
But your body keeps it in check, gets rid of it, and there is no need to sort of like hurry it along when it's already doing its own job. But people really believe that ptomaines and these like really nasty elements just were lurking in your bowel and you had to get rid of them. And it's very easy to understand why people continue to think that and thought that way back when.
Another thing people believed was, or doctors believed at the time, was that if someone was sick, maybe if we remove some of their blood, they'll get better.
Yeah.
Bloodletting.
Bloodletting, which is like, you know, the last movie you saw from like that took place like 100 years ago, like someone's getting bloodletting when they have a fever or something.
Yeah.
It's because it's been around for a long time. And it's all way back, you know, for centuries and millennia, actually, to the time where people thought that you had these four humors in your body, like blood, yellow bile, black bile, and phlegm. And if they were not in balance, then you had to purge something to make it better. And so purging blood was often done because they always thought blood was like way out of balance more than the other humors. So bloodletting, they would cut your arm, it would bleed, they would use leeches, they would do all sorts of things to get as much of this blood out to heal everything. I mean, if you were depressed, they would do bloodletting. If you had a fever, if you had yellow fever, if you had the plague, they would do bloodletting. I mean, everything could be fixed with bloodletting. And mental illness was a big one, too, because, you know, you take a couple pints out of somebody and now they're really anemic and fatigued and they're quieter and people think, oh, I'm making this better. And it was, you know, kind of a horrific way to treat mental illness amongst many other things.
Speaking of mental illness, I wanted to spend a moment talking about lobotomy, because that's in your book as well. And I had this question for you, Dr. Kang, based on what you read about it, what you understand about it, having done this book. This modern intervention of lobotomy, what does it look like to you? Is it about ignorance? Is it about making money? Is it about malice? What do you think motivated doctors to turn to lobotomy?
So that's a really good question, because the guy who made it really famous, at least in the United States, and actually coined the term lobotomy was Walter Freeman. And he was this really strange mix of a showman, somebody who actually did care about wanting to make people feel better, And I don't want to say he's necessarily a charlatan, because he really truly believed in what he was doing. And at the time, there were no good ways to treat some serious forms of mental illness. We didn't have medications, and the hospitals were being overrun with patients with mental illness. People had family members at home, and they just couldn't take care of them well. It was a real big problem. And the way that people were getting taken care of, it was just very inhumane, like in asylums and things like that. And so he comes along with this idea that is sort of taken from a predecessor who had been doing it in Europe, Egas Moniz, and he thought, I can quiet down some of these thoughts that are making these people insane. And a couple times it did work, but, you know, he didn't really talk about the times that it didn't, where it made things worse, where it didn't change anything, where people died from hemorrhages in their brain, where people got epilepsy from the procedures. He was just so enamored and passionate about the actual surgery that I don't think he saw the negative parts of it. He really only saw the positives. But we did see some of this sort of terrible showmanship, this sort of tacky showmanship. He really advertised himself really hard, pushed himself around with every, you know, hospital he could find, touting his wares.
And we'd do demonstrations?
He would do demonstrations. He liked to take, like, when they were doing the ice pick lobotomy, which is when they take the pick and they sort of lift up your eyelid and they tap it into the bone right above your eyeball, and then he would sort of swish it around. But right when that ice pick was put in, he would halt and take a photograph of his patients, almost every single one of them. But he took a lot of photographs, and he would call his patients his trophies. And he would drive around with all his equipment in his car, and he would call it the lobotomobile. I mean, there was that real tacky, icky, awful nature of how he was doing things, and that almost really took away from the initial need that he was trying to fulfill, which was really trying to help mental patients. And so the end of his career kind of coincided with the birth of medicines that actually helped with schizophrenia. And his last patient died of a brain hemorrhage, and that was the end of his career.
Did he have patients who actually got better, I say in quotes, meaning they were able to think more rationally, behave in a more quote-unquote normal way?
He did. He had some patients that I think, from his perspective, did get better. They quieted down if they were more violent. But he also did things like he performed surgeries on children, which is just very wrong for multiple reasons. There's a gentleman named Howard Dully who wrote an entire autobiography about his lobotomy, and he had a stepmother who despised him. He was a normal kid who acted out and maybe wasn't happy about his home life situation, but he did not have a mental illness, and his mother-in-law made him get a lobotomy, and it's just a horrible story. And so, you know, you mix that with, yes, maybe there were some people that might have been helped, but it was done in a very unethical way.
Spanking and fertility. I didn't think these two things could ever be together, but apparently they were at one time.
At one point in time.
And maybe they still are. Who knows? So spanking and fertility. There's a whole section in here in your book on fertility. There's a lot on contraceptives, too. But anyway, how does spanking into this?
So this is actually a very old concept, if you can imagine. So according to Virgil, this is,
it's pretty old.
Back in Roman times,
yeah.
There were these, you know, public orgies where men would roam the streets and spank women. And apparently they thought that this would actually help their fertility. And, it even makes its way into Shakespeare's plays in Julius Caesar when he talks about, touching or spanking a wife so that she'll conceive. So it's actually a very old idea, one that is probably not really considered in most OBGYN offices or fertility clinics anymore.
And you can get arrested these days.
Oh, absolutely. Yes,
yeah.
You can.
Yeah. Well, I got to ask you this. This might be hard for you to answer. Is there one in particular discovery that you made in doing the research where you actually said, oh, I can't believe that they really thought that. Oh, wow. I mean, even, you know, we know that given time and the perspective of history, and obviously people were more ignorant then, didn't understand things, right? There was not a lot of science to this. It was guessing, basically. But there must have been a moment when you were doing research and said, oh, my God.
Yeah, I have a whole chapter of the oh, my God moment, which was the chapter on corpse and cannibalism medicine. That was We did not really come across that at all in medical school. It was just a shock. I'm reading about this, and I'm thinking, they actually drank the blood of gladiators. You know, I remember reading that book Alive about, you know, the soccer team that landed on the Himalayas, and they ended up, you know, there was cannibalism, and it was just this terrible idea. And so when I'm researching this, I'm just thinking about that book going like, why? How are people allowing themselves to do this? But people used to eat other people. They used to...
thinking it would make you healthy.
Yeah, and it was really a kind of... it was a very infantile way of thinking when you look at why they did it. Because they had this concept that you have this life force in you. And let's say you're young and very healthy. You've got a lot of this positive life force. And you want some of that. So you want to get it right when that person dies, and you can get it, like blood from a recently executed young male criminal. You didn't want somebody who was old. You didn't want somebody who had a disease that had been going on and on. And so obviously the place where you could get a nice, young, healthy person recently killed very abruptly would be at an execution. Mm-hmm. And so people would go to these executions in England, and while the criminals were hanging from the gallows, they would go up and rub their hands up against their skin to try to fix, like, you know, boils and warts. Hmm. Or they would drink blood. The executioners were tasked with harvesting the fat from the bodies of the criminals, and then they would package them up, and people would use them as salves. And so they would rub man's grease on themselves to heal, achy joints. It's so horrific that I think I did the entire research for that chapter with my jaw on the floor, because wow.
I had trouble understanding how doctors couldn't accept the idea of germs in the time of Lister and Listerine and the whole idea of, you know, antiseptic surgery, clean surgery,
yes.
Hygiene in surgery. It seemed like there was resistance to it. Like doctors thought these things were, invisible bugs or something like that. They thought it was a lot of hooey.
They did. Well, because, you know, it's hard to prove what you can't see. And you couldn't see germs at the time. They thought they called it humbug. They called it just a bunch of bunk because they said, I don't even know.
What I don't understand is why they couldn't understand the concept of contamination, of something becoming poison from the air. In those days, there were horses, there was mud, there was, you know, the world was an even dirtier place than it is now, right? A lot dirtier.
It is, but they didn't have the perspective. They didn't know any better. It was normal for surgeons to not, you know, wash their hands. They would wear the same coat all the time, and they'd be caked with, like, blood and pus, and they would maybe sometimes wash their instruments, but not always. And that was normal for them. And so having a lot of people die from surgery because of these post-operative infections was a normal thing. And so for someone to come in and say, hey, you're doing it wrong, they're like, this is how it's always been done. This is the status quo, and you don't know what you're talking about. And you know how strong that feeling is because it pervades every day of our lives and so many things about these are the way things are done, and we're going to stick with what's good and old-fashioned because that's the best. So it took some good studies, where people could actually compare, hey, if you have a bunch of people here who are washing their hands and taking care of women who've given birth, and you have a bunch of people here who are not, which place has more people dying? Like, which of the new moms are dying more? And then they said, okay, the ones who are not washing their hands are dying more, but maybe those patients were sicker. So then they switched the people who are washing hands, and the dirty-handed people, like, you know, the deaths followed them. And it took a lot of research and facts before people could look and see that actually they were talking about something that made a lot of sense.
Yeah, and this is actually pretty late in the going. This is like late 19th century, early 20th century.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Lydia, I've enjoyed this. Thank you very much for your work on this book, and it's very enjoyable. Make a great gift.
Anybody who actually cares about their health, which is almost everybody,
yeah,
I think would enjoy this because you can open it up and read it and be like, I cannot believe things were so weird back then.
I can't think of another book that would so make you appreciate living in the 21st century.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Lydia Kang is an author of young adult fiction, adult fiction, and nonfiction and poetry. Her latest book with Nate Peterson is Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything. Now, Dr. John Smarr of Sinai Hospital joins us to help decode lab results. Have you ever been confused or overwhelmed by your lab results? As more Americans gain access to their medical records through online patient portals, they're likely asking more questions about what the various test results mean for their health. Well, at least I am. Today, Dr. John Smarr explains some of the numbers and abbreviations in a four-page report I recently received from my primary care physician. So I had a physical, and I get lab results for the first time mailed to my house.
How exciting.
Yeah, with a little note from my doctor, who I really like. I suppose I could have done this show with him if he was willing to go over this with me. But you're my you're my guy, so I go to you. You're my go-to doc. So I thought it'd be interesting to talk about what's on this thing. There's so much information here. It's basically a data dump on Dan.
And I'm, that's right. A data dump on Dan.
Yeah,
I'm trying
to get a little more information. I mean, generally, the doctor says your PSA prostate level is stable. I guess that sounds good. Your PSA prostate level is stable. The blood counts are normal. The cholesterol levels are outstanding. Overall, your lab results are appropriate.
Now, appropriate.
What do you think of that word, appropriate?
I have never told a patient in my entire medical career that either they or their lab results are appropriate.
Okay. Does that mean appropriate for a man of your age and race and weight and all that?
Yes. I would say that is very likely that, what he means.
That's probably what he meant. Right?
I just love that word choice.
Okay. All right, let's go page by page, if you don't mind.
Oh, sure.
I don't
want to
go over everything, because there's too much here.
No. Yeah.
But when I see white blood cell count, red blood cell count, and some numbers, a ref range, REF range,
mm-hmm.
a reference range?
Mm-hmm. Right, yes, that's exactly
okay.
right.
Okay, what am I looking at there? What's that?
This is, I think, an important thing for us to talk about, because more and more people are having access to their patient portals as an online way that you can get your lab results perhaps at the same time or just after your physician does. It used to be.
This was mailed to my house because I hadn't set up my portal, but otherwise it probably is in there somewhere.
Exactly.
Right?
Okay. And I'll tell you, a few years ago when I was more in the habit of mailing things out to my patients, we actually at Sinai, we had a form. So you weren't seeing all this gobbledygook. I was actually picking like the relevant things and writing them on this form. So you weren't seeing all this stuff, and it's not about leaving off important things, because as you've already alluded to, we're not going to go through everything here because there's no point.
Some of these things say not applicable.
So the first thing that's on here, you see you have something called a CBC with auto differential. That is a complete blood count.
Okay.
And what that is doing is it's looking at the blood and it's breaking down all the stuff that we think is important that's floating in your blood. So white blood cells, red blood cells.
Pretty important.
And platelets. Those are actually, of all these lines, those are like the three main things that are important to look at. White blood cells, because if that's normal, which of course yours are, you are like...
I'm in the normal range. So that's the reference range over in the third column. Okay.
Right, so there's a reference range. So yours are normal, and the white blood cells, of course, there are many things that can make them too high or too low. Typically, infection is a thing that we worry about those being too high in. Mm-hmm. Now, for each of these, the test ends up giving a number, which is the value. Generally speaking, in a normal healthy population, based on studies that have been done and according to the calibrations of this test, if it's within the reference range here, those two numbers, then that means it's normal and you're sort of dead center in the middle of normal.
Okay, I can get that. And my platelet count is in the middle there somewhere.
Right, exactly. So platelets, of course, help you clot. And people who have problems with, you can have problems if your platelets are too high. You can have lots of problems if your platelets are too low. People who have very low platelets, for instance, for any one of a number of reasons, can have issues with bleeding disorders. And so that's just a general part of that. The other thing, the two words that you see there, the hemoglobin and the hematocrit, those are both talking about how much red blood cells you have. Yours are normal. That means you're not anemic. Correct.
If you're looking at this thing, you look at your value and then look at your reference range. And if you're somewhere in the middle, you're probably okay. Right?
Yeah, that's the easiest way to go about it. Absolutely.
All right.
Yeah.
Then we get to comprehensive metabolic.
So essentially, a comprehensive metabolic panel is looking at two things, your kidneys and your liver. That's the easiest way to think about it. So the first half of the stuff is kidney-related things, because your kidneys deal with, say, electrolytes. And so potassium is an important piece of that. If a physician is talking, or a healthcare provider is talking to you about how your kidneys are doing, your kidney function, the BUN and the creatinine, those two numbers are probably the most important in terms of talking about that. Because if that creatinine number is abnormal and yours is delightfully normal, and in this case abnormal would be too high, then that means your kidneys, which are strictly speaking the filters in your body, aren't quite doing their job for whatever number of a bunch of reasons, and so that's something that needs to be investigated. But essentially the top half are electrolytes, things that your kidneys are involved in. That also includes your glucose. So in terms of, that's just your general blood sugar. Were you fasting at the time that you had this blood test done, Dan?
No.
Okay. And that's, and so that's important because it's not that something was done wrong, but it informs that glucose number. Because sometimes, you know, if someone asks you to get a blood test done when you're fasting, it's usually because they want to see what your glucose or your blood sugar and or your cholesterol look like when you have not eaten.
Mm-hmm.
And so what this means is that this glucose, which again is in the normal range completely, is sort of your normal walking around. Maybe you just ate, maybe you didn't.
It looks like sugar. It's on the high side to me.
Well,
the range given here is 65 to 99. My value is at 97.
That is correct. But the thing is that because you weren't fasting, and I have no idea how soon it was before you had your blood done that day. Did you have breakfast? Did you have a bagel? Did you have your morning coffee? All of those things could stimulate your glucose. And even though it looks like it's on the high side, I would say that's still completely normal and appropriate for someone who is just walking around during their day for a random check of your sugar.
Okay. What does pre-diabetic mean?
So pre-diabetic essentially is it's an interesting definition. There are some people who hate the concept of pre-diabetes because in part the reason that it exists as a concept is, so you're not diabetic, but it means you're at risk for developing diabetes. And at one point there was a push partially instigated by a drug company that maybe if you take our blood sugar medicine, even though you're not diabetic, you can prevent yourself from becoming diabetic. And so there are some folks, and I think there is a little bit of validity to that observation, that say that the existence of this pre-diabetes thing, it's not just us saying that you're at a higher risk, but maybe there is another motive for it coming up as a diagnosis. In any case, in general practice, when we look at the idea of pre-diabetes, we look at how your sugars have been running. There's another test that actually I don't think you had done, which is totally fine because you had a lot of tests done. No, actually you did. The second to last page, you had this hemoglobin A1C test.
Oh yeah, I see that. Mm-hmm.
So what that is a test for something called glycosylated hemoglobin, namely the molecule of hemoglobin that's stuck to sugar that's floating through your bloodstream. The difference between, and so that's another test to look at for diabetes. The difference between that one and the glucose is what your blood sugar is right now. And so if you waited an hour, it's entirely possible that your sugar will be a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And certainly if you wait 6 hours or you eat, the amount of sugar in your system is going to go up. So that test is very sensitive to the fluctuations in your sugar right now in your body. The hemoglobin A1C changes very slowly. So the general dictum would be it's indicative of how much sugar has been in your blood, what your normal blood sugar level has been over something like the last 3 months or so. So it changes much more slowly. So it's a better test. So like you said, if you woke up in the morning and let's say you had not had dinner the night before, then we would expect your blood sugar to be very low. And then you went out and you ate 3 pizzas and had a bunch of beer. Of course, it's going to skyrocket.
Right.
But this is going to say, give a better sense of, on average, where is your blood sugar at? And so this number is something that's accepted for two things. One is to screen people for diabetes. Once again, yours is normal. If it
shows an absence of diabetes.
It shows an absence of diabetes. Mm-hmm. And what you'll see there are three number ranges that it gives on the comment underneath.
Yeah.
So you fall within the first one, which is consistent with the absence of diabetes. So
however, in the next category.
Yeah, and the next category is exactly what we've been talking about.
Pre-diabetes.
You've got this 5.7 to 6.4, and it's saying it's elevated not to the point where we would use it to diagnose diabetes, but we would say essentially you are consistently running higher sugars than the average healthy person, even though it doesn't qualify for the criteria of diabetes. And typically when we see this, the goal is to say, all right, what can we do now to intervene to prevent this from potentially getting worse in the future?
Besides a pharmaceutical, the answer to that would be more exercise.
Right.
A diet lower in carbohydrates and sugars.
Right? And sugars, especially refined sugars. And essentially that would be aggressive lifestyle modifications, because that's going to be the best thing that's going to help in that case. The other thing this is used for is if somebody has a diagnosis of diabetes, and this any diabetic will be very familiar with this, this is a number to track how well we are doing in treating it. So when someone is actually taking pills if they have type 2 diabetes, or insulin if they have type 1 or type 2, the physician or healthcare provider will check this on a regular basis to see, all right, is your number very high, or is it going down with treatment? Generally speaking, getting below a 7 is, for people who have diabetes, where we want them to end up being.
I see.
So it serves two purposes. In someone who doesn't have diabetes, it's a screening tool. In someone who does, it can help us figure out how well we're doing.
It tells me that I need to get more exercise. This is the second time I've seen these results for hemoglobin. And yeah, I need to do more.
Exactly.
Because while it's stable, it's still at a place that's probably not good.
Yeah, it could be a little bit lower. I mean, you're not in that middle zone, but it's not towards the high. You're a couple ticks away from it.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah. 5.5.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's a fair tool.
One last thing I wanted to ask you about, John, because there's a lot on here we could talk about.
That's right. Let me just say that your cholesterol really is outstanding.
Well, yeah,
and I'm very jealous of it, and I would like your cholesterol.
That's this is, yeah, I had another doctor years ago who had a German accent, Dr. Mann. He called me up on the phone once, and he said, you know, for an American of Mediterranean ancestry, your cholesterol is outstanding. And I thought it was because I was of Mediterranean ancestry. I don't know. No one in my family had any cholesterol problems, and because they ate a lot of that Mediterranean diet, you know, a lot of fish and olive oil and vegetables, and yeah.
Jardin. Well, if you look at these numbers, obviously.
And so there is a big genetic component, and of course we can tie it to regions where people come from, but irrespective of that, there is a big genetic component to it, but it's also what you eat. And your cholesterol truly is outstanding.
So my question about this, though,
yes,
John, with two things, HDL cholesterol, LDL cholesterol. I know I've asked you about this before, but it doesn't hurt to go over this again.
Of course.
Especially because I can't quite remember. Okay.
So LDL stands for low-density lipoprotein, and all you need to know is that's the bad one. That's the one you want that number to be as low as possible.
Okay, that's the bad cholesterol.
And so when I look at this, and this is the specific reason that I say your cholesterol is outstanding. So mine, I think, is in the one teens, and that is and how we figure out what normal is for this, even though this gives a reference value. This is the type of thing where a reference value for this test can be very misleading, because it really depends on your age, your health problems, a bunch of other factors, what you want to do. So an LDL, let's just say that for someone who has diabetes, the goal is to get it below 70. I can probably count on one hand the number of patients I have in my practice of hundreds and hundreds of hundreds of patients who actually have LDLs that are this low.
Wow.
Naturally.
Hmm.
So yours is very good, but the goal of that is the bad cholesterol. You want that to be as low as possible. The HDL, or the high density lipoprotein, is the good cholesterol. You want that to be as high as possible. And yours is,
I'm hitting 41.
Yeah.
Out of what's a good range? 40.
So they actually don't put a high range on that. And again, it differs by the lab. But for instance, the sometimes normals can be.
It says you want to be above 40 milligrams per, what is it?
Per deciliter.
Deciliter. Okay.
Deciliter. But so sometimes people ask, well, what can I do to increase my good cholesterol? We used to actually try a couple of medications for that for people who are low. The vitamin niacin, we used to give super high doses of that. And that was unfortunate, because it actually made, when you took it, it made you flush, like you became beet red and
really?
Felt kind of funny. And then there has been some question about how well that works. And so that's not something that's commonly recommended now. The easiest way actually to increase this number, or the best way, is just through exercise, because it turns out that doing regular exercise will increase that number.
Not just eating Cheerios.
Not just eating Cheerios, although okay. Cheerios are delicious, Dan.
Well, this has been helpful, John. There is one last thing. So PSA.
It's good for us to talk about this. So PSA stands for prostate-specific antigen. And what it is stuff that is made by the normal cells in your prostate that you can detect circulating in your blood. Normally speaking, you're going to have a very low level of this floating around in your body. If there's something that disrupts the prostate, like if you have prostate cancer or you have prostatitis, a prostate infection, then the level of this is going to be higher. It has been looked at as something to screen men for prostate cancer. And it used to be, years and years and years ago, it was very routine and common to screen everyone, even asymptomatic normal risk men. So a normal risk man would be someone who's not having symptoms, someone who does not have a family member. So it's usually a brother or a father who's had prostate cancer. That gives you a big point for a risk factor. So then you're no longer in the general screening population. You are now special, and so you need to have more attention paid to you. But for the general screening population, general healthy population with no risk factors, we used to do this on a regular basis. We also used to do the digital rectal exam on a regular basis. And my funny aside.
The digital that John's referring to is not electronic either.
No.
So.
As a finger. I once took care of a patient, and I had a team. So it was, I was part of a team of residents, and there was a I was the senior resident, and we had a intern as well as a medical student, and we went in and we explained that we would have to do the digital rectal exam on this person, and then that person made us show them our hands to look at our finger size, and he looked at me because I've got these big monkey hands. He said, "No, not you." But in any case, so we used to use those two things for screening. And essentially what we found about prostate cancer for the average risk person is that if most men, if you end up getting prostate cancer, it's something that is not going to be symptomatic or kill you during the course of your normal healthy life. And it causes so much anxiety when someone gets a cancer diagnosis, and to try to diagnose it, you have to get biopsies.
Right.
And so you have a bunch of needles put into the prostate. And if there's a concern for cancer, then they go ahead and there are surgical ways to deal with it. But because down in that area, there are so many nerves, and then you also have the urethra where the urine passes through that goes through there. Surgical procedures, the classic one is called a TURP, a transurethral prostatectomy. It can cause a lot of nerve damage. It can sometimes destroy your urinary continence. So after the surgery, you may not be able to control your urine. You may not be able to get an erection. And because of all of this, and because it looks like that for a significant number of men, possibly the majority who end up getting prostate cancer, it's never going to cause you a problem, and you're going to die with it instead of because of it. So you'll die of other normal natural causes. And they know this because of doing autopsies on people who've died for whatever reason, and finding that a lot of guys have some degree, when you take the prostate, you look at it under a microscope, you have some degree of prostate cancer in there, that for those reasons, they've been less aggressive about screening for it, because the side effects of the screening are doing extra procedures, extra anxiety, extra surgeries that are causing disability and people to be unhappy and have pain and less satisfying lives. And so for this reason right now, the USPSTF, the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, who makes a lot of the government guidelines for health things, actually recommends against using the PSA as a screening test in the general population who do not have any risk factors. So if somebody has a risk factor, if for instance, that, and I've got someone I was talking with the other day whose father had prostate cancer, and so we had a discussion about using PSA as a screening tool, then that becomes an important thing to make sure that we're checking on a regular basis. Now, all of what I've discussed and why I said this is important to say is that there's actually a lot of controversy And a lot of this is just based on opinions behind the recommendations that I just said, because there are a lot of folks who would believe that, you know, this is still a valid screening tool. And certainly this is something that we should continue to do, because whenever anyone looks at a body of evidence, it doesn't, the evidence is the evidence, and then you form your own opinion, and it's based on your own expertise and thought process. And so I don't blame anyone for having the opinion of saying that, you know, I really want to, even though it doesn't sound like you have any big risk factors, I do want to check this anyway. Mm-hmm. And honestly, sometimes I'll have a patient who will be very strongly interested in having this done. And I will say, well, and honestly, my general practice is I don't routinely screen people for this who are at average risk, who don't have.
My doctor may do it routinely.
Right. So some physicians may still do it routinely. And I don't think that that's wrong, even though a lot of the general guidelines suggest that it doesn't seem to be the best option. And sometimes I'll have patients who really want it done, and I will do it. And I make sure I have this discussion with them.
Yeah,
And especially, too, if you get this and this value is very abnormally high, then that's very significant. The other piece that sort of complicates it, as most guys during the course of our lives, we end up getting bigger prostates, plumper prostates. It's just part of being a man. Medically, we call that benign prostatic hypertrophy, or BPH. That is not a precursor to cancer. It's a totally separate thing. But sometimes, in the context of having a bigger prostate, if it gets irritated for whatever reason, or just by virtue of it being big, sometimes your PSA can go up just a little bit because of that, because you have more prostate to make this stuff.
Right.
And so that can sometimes add complexity to the test.
The word that my doctor used is stable, prostate level stable.
That means he's done it previously.
He
looked at an earlier determination, and yours are stone cold normal.
So generally appropriate, would you say? My results?
Well, I don't know how you as an inappropriate person can have such appropriate lab results.
Lab results are appropriate.
But yes, all of these are entirely appropriate, Dan, entirely appropriate.
Well, thank you, John, for going over this with me. I appreciate it.
Of course.
What do I owe you?
I'm not going to give you a copay for this one, Dan.
Thank you, Dr. Smart.
Thank you so much, Dan.
Gee, I hope you found some of this helpful. Dr. John Smart of Sinai Hospital joins us about once a month to talk about medical news and explain things. Something he does quite well. Before I leave you today for the weekend, attention must be paid to Richard Cross, the mild-mannered, moderate Maryland Republican who contributed to political discussions on Roughly Speaking and earlier my midday show on WYPR. Richard brought informed opinions and rational, practical thought to political discussions. He was a conservative who believed in limited government, but he also had a conscience and a heart. He detested Donald Trump, political extremes, and boorishness. I was among Richard's friends and colleagues who were shocked to learn of his death at age 51 a few weeks ago at his home in Fells Point. I had planned to get him back on the podcast this month. Richard had been a speechwriter for former Maryland Governor Bob Ehrlich, and he worked as a writer at the Republican National Convention last summer. He told me he enjoyed being on the show and became a regular part of our top-notch political panels, along with Kimberly Moffitt, Malia Cromer, Melissa Deckman, Herb Smith, and Peter Jensen. I will miss his voice and his gentle wit and the civil discussions we had. Herb Smith said this, "Richard was certainly a Republican one could talk with in comfort and security, that he didn't believe Democrats were the spawn of Satan. Reasoned political discourse is indeed lessened by his loss." Rest in peace, you mild-mannered, moderate Maryland Republican. There will be a memorial service for Richard Cross on Sunday at the Lemon Funeral Home in Timonium. There's a link to his obituary and details about the service in the notes with this podcast. And that's our show for now. I hope you enjoyed it. Comments are always welcome. Please review the show on iTunes if you get a chance. We really appreciate that. The producers of Roughly Speaking are Steve Early, Quinn Kelly, and sometimes Christina Tasek. This is Dan Rodericks at the Baltimore Sun. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.